KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A federal judge is demanding an explanation for why planes of migrants were not turned around as he ordered. We ask what judges can do if they believe a president is ignoring their orders. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump is putting more pressure on Ukraine and NATO allies, upending traditional U.S. foreign policy. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. We hear from people in Florida about what parts of Trump's foreign policy they agree and disagree with. Also, the story of two survivors of the tornadoes in Missouri and Martha Stewart's quest to join a gardening club. It's Tuesday, March 18th. On this day in 1942, FDR created the War Relocation Authority. It forced more than 100,000 Japanese Americans, most of them U.S. citizens, into internment camps. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Israeli military says its air assault on Gaza is ongoing. Airstrikes started overnight, and health authorities in Gaza say the Israeli strikes have killed at least 400 Palestinians. At least 560 others have been wounded. Israel says it is targeting terrorist cells and infrastructure. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more.
NPR's producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, stood in the courtyard of the Al-Ahli Hospital in Gaza City, the only fully functioning hospital in the north, where scores of bodies were laid out following the strikes.
Women and children, entire families lay dead in front of me here. The smell of blood mixed with gunpowder and burning flesh is returned once more in Gaza.
He says people are in shock at the sudden return of war. The strikes come after a relatively quiet several weeks, as Palestinians in Gaza had tried to start picking up the pieces after more than 15 months of war. The Israeli military has told residents from several neighborhoods to evacuate immediately, saying that Israel has, quote, launched a strong offensive against terrorist organizations. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
In the U.S., a former Columbia University graduate student is asking a federal judge to be released from custody. Mahmoud Khalil is being detained in Louisiana. NPR's Adrian Florido reports the Trump administration is trying to strip Khalil of his green card and deport him over his pro-Palestinian activism.
Immigration agents arrested Mahmoud Khalil at his Manhattan apartment building on March 8th and flew him to Louisiana the next day. The government is resisting his lawyer's attempts to have him returned to New York. He wants to be released from custody while he fights deportation. Khalil's wife is pregnant with their first child and expects to give birth next month. The petition filed by his legal team also asks the federal court to temporarily block the Trump administration from arresting anyone else for deportation because of their pro-Palestinian activism or for protesting Israel and its military operation in Gaza. Adrian Florido, NPR News, New York.
President Trump is scheduled to speak with Russian President Vladimir Putin by phone this morning. Trump has been urging Russia and Ukraine to end the war 3 years after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Ukraine has agreed to a 30-day truce. But NPR's Charles Maines reports before Russia will agree to a specific truce, Putin has set several conditions.
That Ukraine give up territory annexed by Moscow and end its ambitions to join NATO. I put the question of what, if anything, the Kremlin was giving up to Sergei Markov. He's a former Putin spokesman. His answer, a promise not to seize more Ukrainian territory. That is the concession. If there are any concessions from Putin, they appear to be aimed at Trump. Putin is essentially offering Trump business opportunities, everything from rare earth minerals to investments if and when sanctions are lifted.
NPR's Charles Maines reporting. On Wall Street in pre-market trading, Dow futures are lower. This is NPR. A federal judge is demanding a sworn, written response from the Justice Department by noon Eastern Time today. U.S. District Judge James Boasberg wants details of how hundreds of Venezuelan migrants were deported to El Salvador over the weekend. That happened even though the judge verbally ordered the U.S. planes to be turned around. The Office of the U.S. Surgeon General appears to have taken down the webpage that included an advisory on gun violence. That advisory was issued last June by then-Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy. He declared gun violence a public health crisis that leads to loss of life, unimaginable pain, and profound grief. The California legislature is considering whether to divert funding for climate change toward efforts to lower the cost of living in that state. Residents are facing rising energy prices, among other costs. From member station KQED, Guy Marzorati has more.
Fires and heat waves made worse by climate change have driven up the price of home insurance and electricity in California. Right now, money in a state greenhouse gas reduction fund largely goes toward long-term projects like building housing and transit. Stanford climate research scholar Michael Wara says the question for lawmakers
is whether that approach is sustainable or whether we need to be thinking about giving money back to people.
That could mean larger credits to lower residential electricity bills. For NPR News, I'm Guy Marzorati in San Jose.
And again on Wall Street in pre-market trading, Dow futures are down by nearly 100 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. Coming up, a midwife in Texas has been accused of providing abortions despite that state's near total ban on the procedure.
But first, in Gaza overnight, a series of punishing and deadly Israeli airstrikes took Palestinians by surprise.
A Palestinian woman in Gaza City, they're screaming for her children. That was a scene in a hospital in the north. More than 400 Palestinians have been killed and hundreds more injured, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. And Hamas says the airstrikes killed five of its senior leaders. Now, the strikes are the most intensive violence since a tenuous ceasefire began in January between Israel and Hamas as they negotiated an end to the war.
NPR's Hadil El-Shalt, she joins us now from Tel Aviv with the latest. Good morning, Hadil.
Good morning.
So why is Israel launching this attack now?
Well, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been threatening this whole time to go back to war if Hamas did not release more hostages. This time, Israel says it is targeting Hamas militant commanders, wants to degrade Hamas's ability to rearm. That's according to an Israeli official who wasn't authorized to speak publicly. Just a reminder, the first phase of the ceasefire ended on March 1st. Over 6 weeks, Hamas released 33 hostages. Israel freed almost 2,000 Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. The second phase was supposed to see a total withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza and a permanent end to the war. But instead of starting those second phase talks, Israel came back and said it wanted an extension of the first phase, where Hamas would return half the living hostages still held in Gaza.
So what did Hamas say?
Well, Hamas said that it had held up its end of the first phase of the deal and wanted to start second phase deal talks, it refused the extension, which has led to these attacks. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said that, quote, the gates of hell will open in Gaza if all the hostages are not returned. And then we also know that the White House spokesperson Caroline Levitt confirmed that Israel consulted the Trump administration before the strikes.
And what are we hearing from inside Gaza?
I mean, explosions could be heard across the strip. The Gaza Health Ministry says hundreds of Palestinians have been killed, including children. NPR's Gaza producer Anas Baba was at Al Ahli Hospital this morning.
Dozens of bodies lay in every corner here in front of me, wrapped in winter blankets brought by relatives or maybe some ambulances. Women and children, entire families lay dead in front of me here. The relatives are wailing. The smell of blood mixed with gunpowder and burning flesh is returned once more in Gaza.
Also, an Israeli military spokesman warned residents in several Gaza neighborhoods to start evacuating immediately.
So we heard there, Anas, describe really what sounds like war again. Do these strikes mean the ceasefire is done and the war is back on?
So it might be a little too early to tell if the war is fully back on or what these strikes mean exactly for the ceasefire. You know, in recent weeks, Israel has been steadily increasing strikes in Gaza. Hamas hasn't yet responded with its own strikes. But today's assault is, of course, a pressure tactic by Israel to get Hamas to accept that extension. And they're a huge step back. Israel has blocked all aid, including food and medical supplies, 3 weeks ago. So aid groups are rationing quickly, dwindling supplies. And of course, you know, what does this mean for the fate of the hostages still inside Gaza? Israel says 59 remain held by Hamas, 24 of whom are still believed to be alive.
NPR's Hadil El-Shalchi in Tel Aviv. Thank you for your reporting, Hadil.
You're welcome.
A federal judge wants the Justice Department to explain its actions in deportations that took place over the weekend. The judge asked for a sworn declaration from the DOJ by noon today, detailing how planes carrying alleged Venezuelan gang members were flown from the U.S. to El Salvador, despite a judge's orders to turn the planes around. A hearing yesterday saw a debate unfold about when exactly the orders were issued and whether they had to be in writing to restrain government action. So what else can the judicial branch do if a judge believes the executive branch is ignoring an order? Let's ask Michael Waldman. He's a constitutional lawyer and the president of the Brennan Center for Justice. So, Michael, what evidence would demonstrate to a judge that the Trump administration ignored the court's order in this case?
Well, for starters, when did the airplanes take off? It seems that they took off at the very least in the middle of the hearing. Did the administration choose to violate what was a very clear demand by the judge that the planes turn around? This is a major constitutional case. This involves a law that's only been used three times in the country's history. And this judge wants to make sure that it's the courts and not just people in the administration who decide what the law says.
Yeah, so we need to figure that out, right, to be able to kind of pin it down. I mean, it seems like that would be a little difficult.
Well, yesterday in the hearing, the lawyer from the Justice Department basically stonewalled the judge. The president of El Salvador, which is the country where the people were deported to, issued a tweet, I believe, saying, oopsie, too late. So there's quite a bit of impudence where people are saying we don't really have to listen to the courts. It's very fact-based, and this is the kind of thing that eventually will head toward the Supreme Court, at the very least testing the power of courts to enforce the law.
So speaking of listening to courts, in terms of what a president can and can't do, let's listen to White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller talking to reporters yesterday.
The idea that a single district court judge has the authority to direct, as though they were the president, the movement of airplanes around the globe, it is the most outrageous thing I've seen from a district court judge in my lifetime, but frankly, going back multiple lifetimes.
So, Michael, what do you make of that? Does this judge have that authority?
It looks like the judge does. Now, with Stephen Miller and other administration officials, we hear a lot of huffing and puffing about these meddling judges in their robes, you know, getting in our business. At the same time, the White House press secretary said reassuringly, oh, of course we follow court orders.
Trump has always said he follows court orders, that he can always appeal, but he follows court orders.
And in his first term, he did. You know, in some ways, this is talking out of both sides of your mouth, or as they say, the definition of hypocrisy is it's the tribute that vice pays to virtue. Ultimately, the big question will be, in our country, with our Constitution, presidents follow court orders. They do it unhappily very often, very grumpily, but they do. And the question here is, will they follow rulings by a court? Or is this a collision toward a constitutional clash?
Now, the administration has also said that the judge's order was not enforceable because he delivered it verbally, not in writing. Does that matter at all?
Most lawyers don't think that matters. The judge was quite clear. And what he asked the administration to do today was to put down in writing what they knew and when they knew it. The judge is ramping up the precision and the energy of his own orders.
Now, when it comes to options for a judge, what options does any judge have if they believe a president is ignoring its rulings?
Judges do have options. They can hold any litigant, including government officials, in contempt. That is something where it can be civil contempt with fines and other things like that. It could even be criminal contempt, where sometimes people go to prison. If someone refuses to cooperate, there are tools. One of the complications here is the U.S. Marshals, who actually enforce some of this stuff, work for the Justice Department. But the law says they have to follow the rulings of judges. And in fact, sometimes judges appoint private lawyers to prosecute cases if they can't get the government itself to do it. Judges have some tools, but ultimately what will be the main tool is the recognition by this president and all presidents that the Constitution requires us to all follow the rule of law. Public opinion and the demands of history ultimately will be the most important and most effective remedy here.
All right, Michael Waldman is a constitutional lawyer and the president of the Brennan Center for Justice. Michael, thanks.
Thank you.
In what are reportedly the first arrests under the near-total abortion ban enacted in 2022 in Texas, a midwife and an associate have been charged for allegedly performing illegal abortions in Houston-area clinics. The Texas Newsroom's Lucio Vasquez reports from Houston.
Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton says Maria Rojas performed illegal abortions. An employee of one of the clinics, Jose Lay, is also facing similar allegations, according to court records. Paxton did not provide details on the arrests. The Attorney General's office is seeking a court order to shut down the medical clinics where the abortions allegedly took place. The clinics did not respond to interview requests. Legal experts believe the arrests are the first ones made under the state's near-total abortion ban. Brandon Roddinghouse, political science professor at the University of Houston, says the arrests could test the boundaries of the law.
There's a lot of uncertainty right now with respect to the law, with respect to how the law would be applied in a criminal matter.
The ban has provided exceptions for abortions only when a mother's life is at risk, but not for rape or incest. A separate state law made performing an abortion a felony offense after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade back in 2022. Amy Hagstrom-Miller, CEO of Whole Woman's Health, a privately owned abortion provider, says the ban makes it harder for doctors to provide necessary care. In 2022, when the ban went into full effect, Texas's maternal mortality rate went up by 56%. The rate increased by 11% nationally. In a statement on Monday, Paxton said he would do everything in his power to defend the state's pro-life laws. In 2021, he told Fox News,
"I think this bill is defensible, and I think we are going to do a really good job defending it. We already have."
Illegally performing an abortion in Texas is a second-degree felony, which carries a possible sentence of up to 20 years in prison. For NPR News, I'm Lucio Vasquez.
This is NPR News.
A new TV comedy series called The Studio is about a freshly appointed movie studio head trying to keep the company afloat as Hollywood changes around him. The show includes Martin Scorsese, Zoe Kravitz, and Ice Cube playing versions of themselves. On the next Fresh Air, we talk to the co-creator and star of The Studio, Seth Rogen. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We are just days away from the start of spring. For many of us, particularly in colder climates, this means the start of the gardening season. And who better than domestic goddess Martha Stewart to guide us through the planting of our plants, flowers, vegetables, and even trees. Her properties have become iconic for their landscapes and greenery, and she shares her tips and tricks in her Count 'em 100 First book, Martha Stewart's Gardening Handbook. And she's with us now. Martha Stewart, thank you so much for joining us.
What a pleasure to talk to you, Michelle.
So I saw someplace that you started gardening with your father when you were 3 years old.
It might have been earlier than three.
Did you always like it?
Oh, yes, of course. It was being outdoors. We had a fifth of an acre behind a very modest two-story house with three bedrooms and ultimately six children, one bathroom, and the garden was my refuge.
So this isn't your first book on gardening. I think your first one was in 1991, but I think this is the first one in a while. What does this one do that the others don't?
Well, this is a very good handbook. My first gardening book was a very inspirational book about my Turkey Hill garden in Westport, Connecticut. And that went chapter by chapter, month by month. And this one is good for all year long. It's good for the beginner. It's good for the established gardener. It is a very thorough book dealing in all the things one has to know about gardening.
The book is big on design. You say choose the use. What does that mean?
Well, what do you really want to do in your yard? My place is a haven for birds, wild birds. And I also love to grow trees and shrubs. So I've been planting thousands of trees and I grow them from scratch. And the book takes you through all these ways of developing a property. And you can make lots of mistakes and then you can remedy the mistakes. The book goes through that too just don't be afraid. If you've done something wrong, you can change it. Because a garden is not ephemeral. A garden is long-lasting. You can change and alter and redesign and replant, move things. It's not like the house. Once you place your house, it's there. But a garden can evolve. And I love that about gardening.
You talk a lot about in the book about being water-wise, water conservation, and also planting species that are native to the region where you are. Right plant, right place is what you
right.
said. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, there's a huge trend about native plants. And what are natives? Plants that grow naturally in an environment, plants that are not imported from foreign lands, nothing that's too invasive. So you have to choose what you like, first of all. If you like oak trees, plant oak trees, even if they're not really common in your neighborhood. And if you like maple trees because you like the fall color of maple trees, the change of season, then plant maple trees. I have a whole maple woodland. My youngest sister passed away, but her favorite plant was maple trees.
Mm-hmm.
So I planted like a 10-acre woodland with all kinds of maple trees, native northeastern kind of maples, as well as a lot of Japanese maples.
And does that make you think of her when you walk among them?
Well, like we call it Laura's Woodland.
Oh, that's nice.
And her children and her grandchildren come to see Laura's Maple Woodland. And, you know, we miss her, but we have her garden right around us.
You mentioned that you belong to some garden clubs. I have to be honest, aren't people intimidated to be in a garden club with you? I mean, come on.
Well, no. I had to work to get into a garden club.
Really?
I don't want to embarrass my garden clubs too much, but they never invited me. I had my house in Maine for 20-something years, and I was never invited. Even though I let people come for garden tours to see my gardens, I was never invited to the garden club.
What was that about?
Well, who knows? Finally, they asked me for a garden tour, and I said, you know, I'd love to belong to the garden club. And so then I got an invitation. I think it's less about being intimidated by me, just thinking maybe Martha doesn't have time to be a member of the garden club. You know, it takes a lot of work to be a member.
Well, but they should have asked you. I mean, it's let you decide if you want to be in it.
Well, of course they should have, but I'm not, you know what about it. It kind of hurt my feelings that I wasn't considered one of the girls. I wanted to be one of the girls of town. You know, they all belong to the garden club.
Okay, but is it competitive?
Oh, not necessarily.
Because, like, one of the things I like about gardening is it's not competitive. Like, I'm just trying to, like, get my flowers and fruit.
You don't have to show off your plants.
Oh, okay. Just making sure.
I would win lots of blue ribbons if I put my plants in, but I don't do the show so much because, first of all, I don't have time, but I love to go to the shows and see what people are doing.
Also, because you don't want to blow people away. I mean, come on, you can tell. You just don't want to, like, take all the prizes.
Oh, no, that's not true. I would love to take home the prize. but I think gardening is such a joy.
Yes. You know, a lot of people became gardening fans during the pandemic. Are there some common pitfalls for beginning gardeners that you could help us avoid?
Yes. Know how big plants grow and what their growing habits are.
Okay, here's where I'm going to tell on myself. Can I ask you about my pet peeve, squirrels?
Oh, squirrels.
OMG.
That's rule number two. Get a dog.
Really?
Get a dog.
It's the dog. That's the key.
They chase the squirrels away from everything. It's so funny.
So before we let you go, are you doing anything special for the spring? Anything you're particularly excited about planting this spring?
Oh, you should see what we just did in Bedford. I hope my neighbors don't hate me. We have like a half a mile of road frontage outside on my wall. And Bedford is known for its messy roadsides. So I've cleaned mine perfectly, put my new compost all over it, planted, don't choke, but about 80 or 85,000 little bulbs, like little grape hyacinths and crocus and scilla and all kinds of really beautiful little bulbs.
Well, why would your neighbors hate you for that?
When they see it, then they're all going to be embarrassed that they haven't done that to their yards. Gardening is very competitive. My friends are all intense gardeners.
Do you throw shade at each other, though? And do you give, like, snippy comments?
Of course. We try to make each other feel envious of the others. And it's so much fun because there should be no envy at all in gardening. You should be so pleased that other people are doing it.
Martha Stewart's latest book is Martha Stewart's Gardening Handbook, The Essential Guide to Designing, Planting, and Growing. Martha Stewart, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
This is NPR News.
Demand for cheaper alternatives to obesity drugs like Wegovy and Zepbound has exploded in recent years.
We're making millions off of this and helping so many people. There's no way this is going to stop being available.
But an upcoming deadline for factories to stop making alternative versions may cut off those who can't afford the name brands. I'm Elsa Chang. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin will be speaking by phone this morning. They're expected to discuss the U.S. proposal for a 30-day ceasefire between Moscow and Ukraine. NPR's Deepa Shivaram says Trump spoke about the process yesterday.
Trump told reporters that conversations to get to a ceasefire and peace agreement between Russia and Ukraine are ongoing.
I'm involved for humanity. A lot of people are being killed over there.
The president later posted on his platform Truth Social that, quote, many elements of a final agreement have been agreed to, but he did not specify what those agreements entail. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
The Trump administration has fired most of the board members of the U.S. Institute of Peace. Last night, staffers from Trump's Department of Government Efficiency, being overseen by Elon Musk, entered the organization's headquarters despite protests that it's not part of the executive branch. NPR's Michelle Kellerman says an attorney for the USIP says the actions of DOGE are illegal.
We'll have to see what the courts decide and see if USIP employees can get back to their building and regain access to their computers. It'll also be interesting to see if anyone in Congress steps in. After all, Congress created the U.S. Institute of Peace and funds it.
This is NPR News from Washington. NASA astronauts Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore are on their way back to Earth. The two boarded a SpaceX capsule early this morning and undocked from the International Space Station, having spent more than 9 months in space. They're joined by fellow NASA astronaut Nick Hague, as well as Russian cosmonaut Alexander Gorbunov. If the weather cooperates, the four will splash down off the coast of Florida this evening. Williams and Wilmore were originally scheduled for a short stay aboard the ISS last year, but problems with Boeing's Starliner capsule extended their stay into this year. New research examines how iguanas made it to the island of Fiji. NPR's Jonathan Lambert has more.
How iguanas got to Fiji from the Americas has long been a mystery. The lizards could have walked, over many generations, across ancient land bridges, or they could have floated there on a raft of tangled vegetation. New genetic analyses published in the journal PNAS point to the raft idea. The study says Fijian iguanas are likely too young, evolutionarily speaking, to have crossed the ancient land bridges, and that suggests that these lizards floated around 5,000 miles to reach the island. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Stocks on Wall Street opened lower moments ago. The Dow was down 109 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR. And from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. President Trump has reversed a lot of traditional foreign policy positions. To hear how those moves are playing beyond the Beltway, NPR's Frank Langfitt took a trip to St. Petersburg, Florida, and asked around.
I was in St. Pete for an annual conference on world affairs. There are dozens of these local groups around the country for people interested in what's happening overseas. So I set my microphone up on a table and invited anyone to chat.
I'm Alfredo Anthony. I am actually a retired lieutenant colonel from the United States Army.
Tell me what your thoughts are so far about the foreign policy as it's emerging
Right now, it appears as if the foreign policy is one of more of a bully. You're going to do things my way and my way only. Oh, we're going to take over Gaza, Jordan, and Lebanon. You're going to have to take all of the displaced Palestinians. That is not the way, as far as I'm concerned, to truly develop consensus.
Anthony says Trump's approach has limitations. When Anthony arrived here as a kid from the Dominican Republic, he was meek and small.
But I had a temper, and there were two bullies that continued to bully me until I got sick and tired of them, and I just laid them out. So I believe that when you have nations, even if they're smaller, everyone has a breaking point.
President Trump likes to use hard power, such as the threat of military action. But historically, the United States has also used soft power, like foreign aid. One of the conference's attendees, Iqbal Peru, told me that the U.S. Agency for International Development changed his life.
At the age of 17, I was a pilot cadet in the Kenya Air Force. And then one weekend, I had an accident, and that resulted in the amputation of my left leg above the knee.
He visited the USAID office in Nairobi and landed a scholarship to study in America. It paid off.
I'm a healthcare executive who has had a 50-year career in running hospitals, academic centers, and philanthropy, global philanthropy.
Since taking office in January, President Trump has gutted USAID. Peru, who was appointed by President Obama to serve on the board of a U.S. development organization, thinks that's a big mistake.
I got educated because of America. And that is the goodwill that we cannot earn by dropping bombs. We earn that by helping people get education and clean water, access to health.
World Affairs conferences tend to attract more liberal internationalists like Peru and Anthony. So I reached out to other people in town and got a pretty different perspective.
My name is Pete Boland, and I own a couple bars and restaurants here in downtown St. Pete.
Boland says when it comes to alliances, he agrees with Trump that the U.S. often gets the short end of the stick.
We've picked up the tabs for so many different things, you know, whether it be this huge trade deficit or our subsidizing NATO. In a small business, you can't just go spend money frivolously.
The U.S. doesn't subsidize NATO, but it spends more on defense than the rest of the alliance combined. Boland says he's also skeptical about USAID spending.
It's hard to tell what's true, but when you hear things like making a Sesame Street in Iraq, that's the stuff that just really kind of raises your eyebrow.
USAID has funded local versions of Sesame Street for years to help teach tolerance, literacy, and empathy, particularly to kids who've suffered through war and displacement.
Hey, Frank, this is Mark.
Hey, Mark, this is good. This sounds very clear. Mark Higgins is a retired financial advisor here in St. Pete. He says in 2022, he was puzzled as to why people were posting Ukrainian flags on social media, something he said he would never do.
Because I have no dog in the fight. Stand with Ukraine. I don't know what that means. To what extent? To what point?
And Higgins thinks the fighting in Ukraine has gone on far too long.
War is very costly, and I'm all for the president of the United States trying to negotiate a settlement.
But when it comes to Russia, Higgins has a more critical take than the president.
I think they're enemy of the United States, and I wouldn't trust them. I think they're like thugs.
President Trump is breaking with many traditional American foreign policy positions, and even some of his supporters don't agree with all of his views. Frank Langford, NPR News, St. Petersburg.
At least 42 people are dead after the tornadoes, dust storms, and wildfires in 8 states over the weekend. But the death toll doesn't tell the full story of a natural disaster. Surviving a storm is also traumatic. NPR's Frank Morris brings us the story of two people in Missouri who cheated death.
Jeff and Christina Adler stand in a field littered with sheet metal, scanning the hilly woods beyond. This is Wayne County, Missouri, very rural, deep in the Ozarks. Their camping trailer was parked on this spot Friday night when the tornado hit.
All these rocks here were shooting through the windows like somebody was shooting. It just started to tip over and just started rolling, rolling, and rolling. I thought to myself, you know what, this is the way I'm going to die. And right after that, I was laying on the ground, fell out instead of being thrown.
out of the disintegrating camper and into the cold, hard wind and rain just outside the tornado.
I just remember looking up and yelling for him. And he was yelling for me, and he jumped on top of me as the storm was going, and we just held each other.
They were bruised and a little bit cut up, but basically okay. Lucky. A woman camping a stone's throw away from the Adlers died in her trailer. A married couple just across the creek were thrown from their home and killed in the storm. The tornado obliterated the Adlers' camper and flung it a block away.
Our camper's in pieces from here all the way over there. A lot of our camper is in that creek there. The actual frame and tires is laying in the field on the other side of it.
Their trailer was parked semi-permanently on this campground, a refuge from their home 2 hours away in suburban St. Louis. Adler says their belongings were strewn out over 100 yards, but that's not what they're concerned about.
All our stuff, you know, the camper, that's all material stuff.
We don't care about that.
There's nothing in there that was even worth worrying about. Right now, it's doing everything we can to find our dog.
Their dog, Piper, a 10-pound Shih Tzu, 3 years old. Christina says she saw Piper outside the trailer in the storm. But the terrified dog ran off. They've been looking for her ever since.
I think she'll come to me. I know she'll come to me. She hears my voice. She will come to me.
Christina faces the woods and calls.
Piper! Piper Rose, come to mommy! I know she's scared.
Frank Morris, NPR News, Des Arc, Missouri.
This is NPR News. Fault in Our Stars author John Green has a new book that tells the story of TB, which kills more than a million people every year. Next time, here and now.
Our phones hold a lot of stuff, right? Grocery lists, music, pet photos. They also help us stay informed. Listen live on this station's website or NPR.org.
Good morning, May Martinez. Last December, Peruvian fisherman Maximo Napa Castro set out on the Pacific Ocean. Bad weather took his boat off course, leaving him stranded for more than 3 months. He drank rainwater and ate bugs, birds, and a turtle to survive. When he was rescued, he hadn't eaten in more than 2 weeks. He told reporters that what kept him alive all that time, 95 days, was thinking about his mom and his infant granddaughter. Aw, it's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Amy Martinez. The Trump administration is defending the deportation of a Lebanese doctor who was in the United States. It is one of several recent deportations of people who had been living and working legally in the U.S. Dr. Rasha Alawi specializes in kidney transplant issues. She was working for a health nonprofit affiliated with Brown University. Olivia Eberts of Rhode Island member station The Publix Radio has been following the story. Olivia, take us through what happened here.
Well, so the government deported Dr. Alawi last week. It was Friday. And then they said that she had attended the funeral of the assassinated Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah in February. That's while she was home visiting her country of Lebanon. And since then, we haven't been able to get in touch with her to get her response. But I did talk to some of her colleagues. There were a lot of supporters around, and they said that they would be really shocked if she ended up being a terrorist sympathizer. I talked to her boss, Dr. Susie Hu. She's the head of the kidney division at Brown Medicine.
She's wonderful and cheerful and optimistic, hardworking, highly competent.
So Hu and several other doctors who support her told me that she's highly specialized in issues related to kidney transplants, and there are actually only a few other doctors in the entire region who can do what she does.
Yeah, and she was employed by Brown Medicine, which is affiliated with the university. What's been the response from administrators?
So over the weekend, Brown University sent a campus-wide email that was pretty explicit in warning all of its international staff, faculty, and students not to leave the country, especially ahead of spring break. That's because this at Brown is one of several cases where people associated with Ivy League schools, like Columbia, for instance, have had their residential statuses scrutinized or revoked. This, of course, has caused a lot of tension and fear, especially among the international community at a lot of these campuses.
Sure. I mean, so what's the mood then in Providence?
So I don't know if you remember this, but last year, Brown University was one of the many schools that had exploded in these pro-Palestinian protests. But after a number of crackdowns nationally and on campus, it's been a really quiet year so far in terms of protesting. But last night, everything with this doctor seems to have sort of mobilized this again. And this time it was at the Rhode Island State House, which is not very far from Brown. Lots of protesters came out, and lots of them were affiliated with Brown. I talked to Timmons Roberts, who's a sociology professor at Brown, and he said he's thinking about international faculty and students who have participated in pro-Palestinian protests all throughout last academic year.
Students who have protested in the past are worried about their ability to do so in the future. Their freedom of speech really is at stake here, I think.
So people are really starting to believe that any non-U.S. citizen who's demonstrated pro-Palestinian viewpoints or viewpoints not aligned with the American government could be deported.
So what's next for Dr. Alawi?
Dr. Alawi is suing the federal government to try to get back onto U.S. soil, but I don't think we'll start to see movement with that legal case until next month.
Okay, that's Olivia Eberts of Rhode Island member station, The Publix Radio. Olivia, thanks.
Thanks.
This is NPR News. Thank you. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. In Wyoming, the Conservative Freedom Caucus has a lot of clout with lawmakers, and the state's latest legislative session was an important example of what this caucus can do politically. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements reports.
The Freedom Caucus is a national movement, and last fall, Wyoming became the first state where it won a majority of a legislative chamber, the Wyoming House of Representatives. This session, its members cut property taxes, banned diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and passed more residency requirements for voting, among other things.
I'm quite pleased with the outcome of the session. We had several goals, and most of those have passed.
That's Freedom Caucus State Representative John Baer. Throughout the 37-day session, House and Senate clerks announced caucus-backed proposals, limiting the rights of transgender people, or cracking down on immigration.
House Bill 32, sponsored by Representative Ling. What is a woman act? Mr. House Speaker. Bill 72, sponsored by Representative Lawley. Protecting Women's Privacy and Public Spaces Act.
Senate File 124, Illegal Immigration, Identify, Report, Detain, and Deport, an act relating to immigration.
But a few lawmakers noted that they were shaking up the usual order of things. Here's Republican State Representative Steve Harshman, a former speaker.
You bring the non-controversial, the easy fixes, the committee-type bills first, because most of these bills are little problems that a constituent has brought to us, and they're pretty simple fixes.
Republican Representative Lloyd Larson cited the failure of one bill in the works for years aimed at letting state agencies share more information about family services.
For example, how many children that were in foster care also required X services, and how many of them's lives improved after receiving that?
The Freedom Caucus led the repeal of the state's ban on guns in certain public buildings. Republican Governor Mark Gordon let it become law without his signature, saying the legislature was undermining local government control.
The unfortunate thing is in the process, they steamrolled the excellent work being done by places like the school system in Uinta.
That school district allows concealed carry, but mandates a psychological evaluation before staff can bring firearms to campus. That requirement is not in the broader repeal that's now law.
There was an effort to sort of demonstrate a certain amount of machismo, I think is what you'd say.
Gordon did veto a caucus-backed bill to require transvaginal ultrasound exams 48 hours before a person can receive abortion medication. But the legislature overrode the veto, and it's taking effect now. For NPR News, I'm Chris Clements in Laramie, Wyoming.
Rwanda is widely held to be backing the M23 rebel group. They've taken over much of the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo in the last 2 months. Rwanda, though, denies that. But the DRC wants organizations around the world to break ties with Rwanda. Here's NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu.
Rwanda has emerged to show a different face to the world after over 30 years of rebuilding and progress since the profound horrors of the 1994 genocide.
This is amazing. Wow, Rwanda, Rwanda, I love you, Rwanda!
Masai Ujiri, president of the Toronto Raptors basketball team, on a visit to Rwanda, celebrating it as a premier destination and partner in Africa.
I love you, President Kagame. You are a friend. You are unbelievable. Yes. I don't care what the world says, we keep marching.
Many like Ujiri have praised President Paul Kagame for transforming Rwanda to a nation on the rise.
Rwanda, stand up.
The country's partnership with the NBA is just one of many in the sports world alone. But these partnerships have come under scrutiny as criticism of Rwanda grows.
NBA Academy Africa is coming to Kigali.
The DRC has accused Rwanda of invading the east of the country and exploiting its minerals through a joint offensive with the M23 rebel group. Congolese officials say the M23 has killed more than 7,000 people since January, a figure that is impossible to independently verify.
I think the politicization of our sports partnership is unjustified and wrong.
Yolande Makolo is a spokeswoman for the Rwandan government. Visits Rwanda, a company funded by the government, promotes tourism to Rwanda and sponsors Paris Saint-Germain, Bayern Munich and Arsenal, some of the biggest soccer clubs in the world. but all three clubs have faced calls to suspend their deals.
It's blackmail, and we're going to challenge this and fight back.
Rwanda has accused the DRC of not doing enough to isolate and prosecute Hutu militias responsible for the 1994 genocide, where almost 1 million mostly Tutsis were killed. Many Hutu militias then fled across the border to DRC. Rwanda says it's defending Tutsi minorities, and it's denied backing the M23, but widespread evidence from UN experts and government, including the US, has meant few believe them. Here's Makolo again.
I don't think our partners should bow to this pressure because we're doing very good work together. I mean, as Africans, we're trying to grow our economies so we can be less dependent on aid.
Last month, the US sanctioned James Kabarebe, a minister in Rwanda's government, for orchestrating Rwandan support for M23 and generating revenue from DRC's minerals.
And on Monday, the European Union sanctioned a Rwandan gold refinery and several Rwandan military officials and M23 fighters.
Rwanda's most important export is its reputation.
Jason Stearns is a senior fellow at the Center on International Cooperation at New York University.
He said the pressure on Rwanda is growing, but hasn't come close to what the country faced in the past. The US completely cut development aid following a similar offensive by M23 more than a decade ago.
Then there was much, much stiffer pressure on Rwanda brought to bear by the donor community.
But Rwanda has become an important partner to Western countries since then, including by providing military support for peacekeeping missions in places like Mozambique.
Rwanda has been able to make itself needed. I think that's one of the reasons that donor countries have been so reluctant to crack down on what nobody is questioning really is massive Rwandan intervention in eastern DRC.
So for now, Rwanda's attraction to international organizations and governments alike appears to be shielding it from harsher sanctions, all while the M23 advances and millions in eastern DRC continue to pay the price. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
Thank you.